Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, career, family, home, travel, these are things many of us aspire to. Things that make us happy and amount to success. According to best-selling author David Brooks, these are the kind of achievements that await us at the top of the first mountain, something most of us try to climb in early adulthood. Some people get knocked off that mountain by trauma or tragedy. Others make it to the summit only to feel nothing much at all. Brooks talks about a second mountain in his new book, a mountain that's defined not by self, but instead by serving others. We'll talk to him about how most people start this second journey and how instead of happiness, it yields deep joy. Our conversation starts after a short break. Happiness and joy the same thing? Is there a difference in your mind between a career and a vocation? Best-selling author and New York Times columnist David Brooks distinguishes them, assigning happiness and career to what he's dubbed the first mountain, and joy and vocation to the second. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Climbing the second mountain is getting past the aspirational goals of job success and starting a family, and moving toward a life lived outside the self, a life devoted to something more. David Brooks outlines the path to get there in his new book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, and joins us now to talk about it. David, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
So I was really interested in the beginning of the book, you talk about the moral ecology. Can you kind of describe what that is and what purpose it solves?
Yeah, well, I use it. I describe it by going back to one of my heroes and a great PBS and NPR figure who began his career here in Dallas, and it's Jim Lehrer. So I was hired in 2001 to be a pundit on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and on the air he's a very reticent looking guy, but off the air he's an extremely expressive guy. And so when he was off camera and I was saying something that he really liked, then his eyes would crinkle in pleasure. And when I said something he thought was crass or cheap, his mouth would turn down in displeasure. So for 10 years, I just tried to attract the eye crinkles and avoid the mouth downturn. And so that's sort of the way a mentor sets an emotional tone for a place. What's right, what's not. He never said anything to me. It was just those reactions. And so he trained me that way, with just with those little gestures of how to be a pundit. And he set the tone for how I was going to behave. And it wasn't only me. He set the tone for everybody at the organization. And Lehrer's probably been retired 5-7 years by now. But it's still that moral ecology, that set of norms and standards is still there. And all of us in our daily life are setting a tone for the world around us. And it could be a good tone and a bad tone. And I think one of the precious things anybody could leave behind is a moral ecology, a set of way of being that other people carry on after you're dead.
And the moral ecology extends when you talk about, you know, community and society. And obviously, there's a time and a place for kind of like the collective response to the big problem. So talk to me a little bit about how the moral ecology of maybe the 60s has led to a very interesting era of individualism today.
Yeah. So if you grew up in the 50s or from the 30s to the 50s, you grew up at a time when people need to solve big challenges, the Great Depression, World War II. You had to join big organizations like the Army or IBM or General Motors. And so they had an ethos that was very communal, and it was we're all in this together. And it was great in some ways. If you said you're from if you're from Chicago, you didn't say, I live in Chicago. You say, I live at 59th and Pulaski, because that specific small neighborhood was your world. And it was a very tight world, and it was great. The problem was that world eventually came to seem too confining. And too racist and too sexist and too anti-Semitic. So in the 60s, we sort of chopped it up. And people wanted to be free and they wanted to be liberated. And so they created an ethos starting in the early 60s, I'm free to be myself. And one of my heroes in the 60s was a guy named Joe Namath, who was a quarterback for the New York Jets. And he was anti-institutional. He was a swinger. He was wide open. He wrote a memoir called I Can't Wait Until Tomorrow Because I Get Better Looking Every Day. And so it was all about self-display. And so we had a culture that was very individualistic. Now we've had about 60 years of that, and we've sort of run the string out on it. And if you have 60 years of hyper-individualism, you end up weakening the bonds between people, and I think that's what we've done.
And talk to me about hyper-individualism. It seems really self-explanatory, but really the idea is I'm free to be myself, but it goes further than that. It's I'm completely free to do whatever I want to do.
Yeah. This book is really about two different moral systems, one we're stuck in and one I think we should venture toward. And the moral system of individualism and the meritocracy is based on a bunch of lies. One lie is that career success makes you fulfilled, and it doesn't. Another lie is I can make myself happy. that the things I do individually, like lose 15 pounds or get better at yoga, those are the things that'll make me happy. And that's the lie of self-sufficiency.
No, go ahead. I'm going to signal for something.
The lie of self-sufficiency is that we can do things on our own. But the people who are really happy, those are the ones who defeat self-sufficiency, and they become relational.
I was amused that you kind of rag on something in the book, which I was amused by. And that thing that you rag on is the college commencement speech. So we're going to hear a clip for just a second.
So many of us choose our path out of fear disguised as practicality. What we really want seems impossibly out of reach and ridiculous to expect, so we never dare to ask the universe for it. I'm saying I'm the proof that you can ask the universe for it. My father could have been a great comedian, but he didn't believe that that was possible for him. And so he made a conservative choice. Instead, he got a safe job as an accountant. And when I was 12 years old, he was let go from that safe job. And our family had to do whatever we could to survive. I learned many great lessons from my father, not the least of which was that you can fail at what you don't want. So you might as well take a chance on doing what you love.
So for those of you not recognizing that voice, that was actually Jim Carrey giving the commencement speech for the class of 2014 at Maharshi University of Management in Iowa. That was a pretty typical college commencement speech. Shoot for the stars, follow your dreams. And why do you take issue with that?
Well, first, commencements are where they take people with a lot of career success and they give a speech about why career success doesn't matter. And then they say, don't be afraid to fail, from which you learn that failure seems kind of great if you happen to be Jim Carrey or J.K. Rowling. Like, sometimes failure just sucks and you should not fail. I'm against failure. My main beef is that students are leaving college and they want to know what do they devote their lives to. What should they do? And so we give them big boxes of nothing. We say, follow your passion. They don't know what their passion is. We say, look inside yourself. Well, the self is exactly what hasn't formed. The authorities are not in yourself. And then we say, take risks, be big. That doesn't give them any actual direction about what kind of life is better than another. So basically, they've got the big questions of life. What's the worthiest life? And we basically say to them, you're on your own. And we have no moral system to hand down to them. And so it's super tough to be in your 20s these days because nothing is handed to you.
There's two types of college grads you talk about in the book, and I'm going to call one the whitewater rafting instructor and the other one the McKinsey consultant. Yeah. Describe the difference between those two types of graduating seniors.
Yeah, the first is leading what Kierkegaard called an aesthetic life, or we would call an Instagram life, leading a life that everything is a series of wild adventures and has a good time, goes to go to Burning Man, gets to do whitewater rafting, but it doesn't actually accumulate into anything. And after a while, it stops to thrill. And so that's one kind of life. The other way to insecurely build your life is you got into college and you liked attaching yourself to prestigious brands like your college. So you figure you'll treat life as college and attach yourself to prestigious brands, McKinsey or whatever it's going to be. And the problem with that is you haven't solved the foundational problem of your life is why are you here for? What are you doing? And so as one writer said it, people think they can solve the problem they don't want their foundation is by building a shiny new story of success up on top. And eventually that comes crashing down.
Foundationless. Talk to me about the hallmarks of that first mountain. It seems like, first of all, I guess I should ask this. Does every single person climb the first mountain? Does anyone skip it and get straight to the second?
Yeah, my wife went to her second mountain first. So she's lucky. She became very spiritually deep at a very young age. And this is a metaphor for two different moral systems, the one our culture endorses, which I think is inadequate, and the one we should strive toward. But basically, you get out of school, and this was true of me, say, you get out of school, you're going to make a career for yourself in journalism for us, and or a cop, teacher, whatever it's going to be, and you want to make your mark on the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. But so you're building your way up, and then you achieve success, and you find it's weirdly unsatisfying, or else you fail. Or else something hits you that wasn't part of the original plan. You have a cancer scare, you lose a child, which makes the desires of the ego seem small. And so basically on the first mountain, you're doing a lot of reputation management. How do I feel? How do I look? What do people think of me? It's all about the ego. But when you slide into the valley, you pierce deeper into yourself and you become more familiar painfully with the yearnings of your heart and soul, the desire to be fused with another and the desire to serve some ultimate good. And when you've made that realization, you're ready for a much bigger and larger life.
And I did want to ask you about the valley. So as you said, some people just climb to the top of the first mountain and get there and shrug at it all because it just doesn't feel like much. Do they just kind of walk down the other side into the valley?
Well, I think they have period of wandering. I mean, I've done much better than I ever thought I would in career terms. And I can tell you that career success gave me no positive benefit into my life, into my emotions, to my heart and my quality as a human being. It spared me from the shame I might have felt if I felt myself a failure. But it gave me no positive good. And so I got to be a New York Times columnist. I got to write books. I get to be on NPR. But that's not really the things that are really fulfilling in life. And so you just think there's got to be more. And I run into this all the time. I just ran into a guy who was a banker for 25 years, and he just didn't find it was this what he was called to do on this earth. And so he left, and now he helps guys come out of prison, transition to back to life, and his eyes glow when he talks about that stuff. And you don't always have to leave your job to have a second mountain, but you treat it differently. You treat it less about my own personal success and more about mentoring people at the workplace. You make it more – your life is about relationship and cause and mission.
And as you said, some people get knocked off the first mountain before they even get to the top by a trauma, a tragedy, a health scare. What is it like down in the valley? Of course, the valley is your metaphor for just what happens when you're low. What's it like
there? Or adrift. Well, I think you can first, you're feeling more than you ever felt before since you were a kid. And it's bad feelings, but it's still feeling. And second, I've come to believe you can be broken or you can be broken open. And the people who are broken react to that pain by shriveling up and protecting. And they feel resentful to the world. They lash out. They turn tribal and angry. As somebody once said, pain that is not transformed gets transmitted. And some people get broken open. They just become more vulnerable. And what Paul Tillich, a great theologian from the 1950s, said, what suffering does is it reminds you you're not the person you thought you were. It carves through the floor of the basement of your soul and reveals a cavity below that, and it carves through that floor and reveals a cavity below that. You just see deeper into yourself than you'd ever seen before, and you realize only spiritual and emotional food will fill those cavities.
I do want to talk about the social valley that you outlined. It's upsetting to think about kind of the different things that make that up, loneliness and distrust and meaning. Talk to me, you just referenced tribalism. Why is tribalism so very different from community?
Yeah, tribalism, seems like community because it's a sort of bonding, but it's the dark twin of community. Community is based on mutual affection. We love Texas together. Tribalism is based on mutual hatred. We hate the other together. And so tribalism is based on a scarcity mentality. It's always us versus them, friend, enemy. It's a zero-sum struggle for survival. It's built based on distrust. And it's about erecting barriers and walls and dividing people. And so if you leave people naked and alone, which I think our individualistic culture does, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do, and they revert to tribe. Mm-hmm. And we see that in our politics every day, and I see it daily life in what I do. It's tearing the country apart. And so my fear is that we'll move from this I'm free to be myself individualism. Our next historical era will be defined by revert to tribe, and that would just be a horrible era to live in.
And you specifically pointed to loneliness, and interestingly enough, I did a show yesterday about raising boys, and loneliness is a big topic there with boys and men. Why is it such a problem?
Yeah, I think we've just weakened the bonds between us. We have this individualism, this ethos, you can be self-sufficient, and we just don't treat each other well. I can say it happened to me. I talk about my own time in the valley. And I had turned into a workaholic. I just was not communicating well with people. And building relationship is a real skill. And living for some ultimate good, living in the way your soul wants you, you have to work on it. And so you have to have emotional education. And we don't do that. And sometimes we do the reverse. And so in the case of boys, I don't know if you had Niobe Way on, but there's a writer who writes about boys. And she points out very accurately that young boys at 5 and 6 are phenomenal at friendship. And they're deeply emotionally revealing. But then there's something about their culture that tells them at 11, oh, you got to hide your emotions and you got to distance yourself from your emotions or you're going to be cool. And it tells girls at the same time, if you tell people what you're really feeling, they won't like you. And so we have a culture that encourages people to distance themselves from their emotions. And then at 16, we put the luckiest of them into a college admissions process that says status and accomplishment are going to be at the center of your lives, not relationship. And so we get sucked into a set of bad values, and that happened to me.
Our guest this hour is David Brooks. He's New York Times columnist and best-selling author. His book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be back after a short break. Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is David Brooks, New York Times columnist and author. His book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. So we talked a lot in the first segment, about the first mountain, how it's marked by all these traditional aspirational goals, career success, finding someone to be with, having kids, getting started in life. And then you talk a lot about how the journey toward the second mountain doesn't always happen in the way you might expect. But how do most people find themselves trying to climb that second mountain, which is very different from the first?
Yeah, often they get called. It's about a summons. It's about answering a summons. And they answer this question, what's my responsibility in this situation? What problem is there around me, or what relationship is there around me that I want to give myself away to? And that comes in just four general categories, I say, four big commitments in our life: to a spouse and family, to a vocation, to a community, or into a philosophy or faith. And most of us give ourselves away to one or even more of those four big commitments. And it often comes, something happens. I've spent my life, the last year, traveling the country, meeting real community builders. And often something just happens that calls them. And so I met a woman in New Orleans. She was a healthcare executive, and she was driving one day, and she saw two scared little boys, 10 and 11. And the scared little boys lifted a gun, and they shot her in the face. And this was their gang initiation ritual. And she recovered, and she remembered that she was a victim, but those little boys were a victim, that they felt they had to shoot somebody to get into a gang. And so she left her job as a healthcare executive and works with gang members, and now works in the city of New Orleans. And so that became her calling. Sometimes a problem gets plopped in front of you, and that becomes the calling you've decided, I'll give myself away to. But it could be other things. It could be serving a community, or journalism, or writing, or anything.
And you, in the last several years, have had kind of the gift of perspective with working with the nonprofit, and have gotten to know so many people in the nonprofit sector. Just share another story or two about people who've felt called and have done something that you wouldn't even think of. It's so remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stories are amazing, and these are very atypical, but I started a thing called the Aspen Institute called Weave, the Social Fabric Project, and we plop into a town and we find weavers. Mm-hmm. Wherever you go, we spent a lot of time in Houston and found a lot of people there. Some remarkable woman named Stephanie Ruzek, who works at an after-school program. There was just a Latino neighborhood there that didn't have any place for the kids to go after school. So she participates in this program, and she just plays with them. And it's just joyous to be around her playing with kids every afternoon. And now the kids come from all over. And she's created a community. She's a weaver. Some of the stories are horrible. I was in Ohio, searing afternoon I spent with a woman named Sarah, who was out antiquing with her mom for a weekend, came home on a Sunday evening, and found that her husband had killed their kids and himself. And she now runs a free pharmacy. She helps moms who are suffering from violence in their homes. She teaches at Ohio University. And she said, I did it because I was angry. Whatever that guy tried to do to me, I wasn't going to do it. I was going to lead a life of purpose and meaning. I was going to make a difference in the world. And she is living a life for others. And it's a dramatic valley that she had to go through and still is not really out of. But she lives just for giving herself away.
Do some people never even start the process of climbing a second mountain? Are some people happy on the top of the first, or just live in the valley for the rest of their days?
Yeah, I was trying not to discuss our president. I think he's a first mountain kind of guy. No, I do think some people do. But I think most people, they fall into themselves. And I found people get better at living as they go along. And they really come to operate from a deeper part of their life. And this was true of me, I started life very shallow. And if you're a decent communicator, it's very easy to live in the world of glibness until life toughens you up or tenders you up by hitting you a little. And then you want to get beneath the glibness and to live out of some genuine spot in yourself. So I think, not everybody, but most people I meet, and the people I meet who are really joyous, they live their life. They know it's not about themselves. What problem has been put in front of me that I can help be a part of a solution to? And sometimes just serving your town. I ran into a guy in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. There was no place for kids to gather, so he opened a coffee shop. And so he's serving his town that way. There are many ways to create community, create relationship.
I loved the story of the book. You said someone spoke to a crossing guard and said, do you do any volunteer work? And that crossing guard said, no, I don't really have any time. But she was a volunteer crossing guard and also was taking meals right after her crossing guard shift over to people who didn't have any food. So to her, she didn't even think of it as volunteer work. It was just part of who she was and how she lived.
Yeah, well, we too much emphasize like nonprofits, but sometimes neighboring is just being a neighbor, and just when there's always that lady, frankly, sometimes a man who, when you move in, they're the ones who show up on your doorstep. If you're walking down the street, they're the ones who introduce you to the other neighbor. They're the weaver there. And in D.C., we go into neighborhoods and we ask who's trusted here, who does everybody trust? And in one neighborhood called Columbia Heights, it was the guy who worked at the toll booth at the parking garage. But everybody knew he was going to connect everybody else. And those people are just tremendously valuable. And that's what neighboring should be. I was in New Orleans, and I said to a group of people there at one of our dinners, you know, it's sad that none of us know our neighbors, that we don't know, like, the 15 families that live closest to us. And they looked at me blankly, and they said, we all know our neighbors. So in some places, it still works that way, but in other places, it doesn't.
If you want to join the conversation, the number to call is 800-933-5372. Let's hear now from Joyce in Galveston. Joyce, you can go ahead.
So, David, it sounds like you didn't grow up with people like my relatives out of Louisiana. Because the senior citizens took the kids by the hand and showed them how to do this right, you know. So I was a hidden figure in corporate, but I still knew how to make that gumbo, baby, and I knew how to go and help at the church. And so it's been a wonderful blended life. I'm almost 68, and I look like, they tell me, about 15 years younger. It helped.
Now, have you found that? Do people feel like it kind of ages them down to live this way?
Well, if you hung around young people, you age backwards. I do think that Benjamin Button thing. And I think that's true if you live in certain places. The culture is warm, and it's frankly a little more true in the South. I grew up in New York City, and there's an understanding that you won't talk to your neighbors in the elevator or on the hallway because there are so many people around, it would just get crushing. But that's a colder experience, and I long for the experience where people will just go out of their way to be kind to you.
Tell me the difference between a career and a vocation. I think you've already hinted at it in your experiential talk, What's the difference?
Yeah, a career is something you take your skills and you look at the marketplace and where can I get the most reward for my skills? And so the crucial question in a career choice is what am I good at? And it's a utilitarian choice. And sometimes we have to make that. We've got to make a living. But a calling, you are called by either something outside you, a problem that appeals to you, or some sense of beauty. I write in the book about E.O. Wilson, a great scientist. When he was 7, his parents were getting divorced, so they shipped him out of his home state and down to North Florida, a place called Paradise Beach. He'd never seen the ocean before, or the bay, or the Gulf. And he looked at it when he was 7. He just wandered the beach, and he saw a jellyfish, and he'd never seen a creature like that. It was outside of his imagination. He saw a stingray float beneath his feet at a dock. And he was just seized by the need to understand that. And he pointed that out, that when you're a kid, you see animals at twice the size you see them as an adult, which I think is true. And so he was so captivated by beauty that he says at that moment a naturalist was born. It was just built out of wonder. And so he is now in his 80s, I imagine, and he's one of our greatest scientists, and he's a naturalist.
He studies ants.
He wanted to study fish or birds, but when he was fishing that summer, when he was 7, he was taking a fish off the hook and it flapped into his face and his tail fin poked his retina.
Oh, my.
And he lost vision in that eye. So he couldn't study anything that required, double vision to see depth. But ants you can hold up to your one good eye. And so he could study ants. And he started out studying ant colonies and ant behavior, but now he's broadened out to much more.
So sometimes you just know that you're being pushed in a certain direction. A little anecdote you included in the book that I thought was funny is that you have a Fitbit, and your Fitbit thinks you're sleeping every day during a certain period of time. Tell me why that's relevant.
Well, I read a book called Paddington the Bear when I was 7 and decided I was going to be a writer, and I've pretty much written every day, and it's sort of where I feel at home. And so I was wearing a Fitbit in a vain attempt to get in better shape. And I looked at the thing, and it told me I was sleeping between 9 and 11 every morning. On the little graph, and I said, well, I'm not sleeping then, I'm writing then. And so apparently my heartbeat must slow, and so it thinks I'm sleeping, but I'm just at peace because I'm doing what I was put on this earth to do.
That's so great. Again, the number to call, 800-933-5372. Let's take a call from Robin in Lexington, Kentucky. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really enjoying listening to this show, and it's this conversation is so timely in my life right now. My husband and I kind of had the perfect life, three kids. We're both really fulfilled in our careers. He was an EMS helicopter pilot, and I was an ICU nurse. And in August, we lost our five-year-old middle child to brain cancer. That has no cure and is resistant to all treatment, basically has 100% mortality rate, and that has completely redefined our lives. My husband was let go from his position as a pilot because his coworkers were worried about the safety of flying with someone with that kind of psychological trauma, and I haven't been able to return to work in a neurosurgery ICU environment, so I'm making a big transition in my career. I hadn't really defined this issue of a second mountain, and David, I really appreciate you speaking and writing on this topic. I'm really excited to read your book. It wasn't one that I had heard of. I've started a chapter of a national nonprofit to help fund research for the type of brain cancer that our son had. And my question is, and the book might answer some of this for me, and I'm really looking forward to reading it, what steps can we take once we've kind of identified what our second mountain will be to accomplish that successfully? We definitely want to be effective and make an impact and do something meaningful in our lives as we make this transition. But do you have any advice on actually how to accomplish that? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Well, the first thing to say is I'm so sorry. I've learned when something horrible happens to someone, you just acknowledge that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sorry for what happened. As you were speaking, I was reminded of a friend who lost her child when he was about 4 or 5. And she went through the grieving process, and she created something called Hope for Henry. Henry was their boy. And what Hope for Henry does is it found a need. And the need was that kids in a lot of these hospital enduring long illnesses, there's not a lot of entertainment for them in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so she would bring in men and women dressed up in superhero costumes, and she would train the kids to be superheroes against their disease. And it's now probably 15 years old, it's very successful, and I think it's given meaning to their lives and helped them deal with what happened to them. And one of the things I like about it, it's like being an entrepreneur a little. You go in with a problems-seeking mentality. What are the problems around me? What are the problems relating to the core problem? And some of it is a problem of research, not knowledge, but there may be a lot of problems that you faced when your own son was going through that. And maybe you can think of a way, how can I solve that specific problem? For example, the problem of not having a lot of entertainment in the hospital. And they've created so much good for so many people through how they've recovered. And one of the things I just noticed, when people suffer grief, they never just try to be hedonistic. They don't say, oh, we've suffered this pain, let's go off to Hawaii. They really want to have meaning. And life is about intensity, not about happiness in this circumstance.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. The marriage section of this book is interesting because I assume that you could really put marriage in the first and the second mountain. I mean, that seems like something you need to check off maybe in your first mountain. But what is the maximal marriage that you talk about on the second mountain?
Yeah, and this is something where I don't pretend high holy ground. I hope on either. I've had a divorce. I've failed at a marriage. I do think that the first mountain marriage, and there's a book by Eli Finkel that describes the common model of marriage, which is two people helping each other along in their individual journeys in life. And I believe in a covenantal marriage, that it's a complete surrender to the other. You defeat the other, the ego, in order to serve the other. And there's a passage in the book from a guy named Tim Keller, and he says that about 2 years into marriage, you discover the person you thought was really perfect is actually kind of selfish. And then as you're making this discovery about her, she's making it about you. And so you can see that, oh, this is a selfishness problem. And you can have a truce marriage where you decide not to talk about each other's selfishness, or you can have a covenantal marriage. And when in a covenantal marriage, you say, well, actually, the core selfishness in our marriage is not her selfishness. It's my selfishness. Your own selfishness is the only one you can control. And the Kellers say that when two people in a marriage each decide their own selfishness is the core problem there, you're likely to have a good marriage because they're just going to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the relationship.
Do some people that are, you know, living joyfully on the second mountain, have they made marriage kind of the focal point of that life?
I think some people have. You come across people who have been married 50 and 60 years, and they've come out the other side, and they just radiate a joyful. They've got the golden ticket. I think the greatest, most joyful people I meet, sometimes they're religious people, but often they're people who are just fortunate enough to found a love and then have worked harder through it. I mean, I try to describe in the book not only these ethereal things, but practical things to do. And so in marriage, there's ups and downs, but some of the bits of advice I repeat from other people wiser than myself are sometimes you just go to bed. You know, they say you shouldn't go to bed mad. Sometimes just go to bed and make breakfast in the morning. It'll seem a lot better. Boast about your spouse and have them overhear you boasting. That's a nice thing to do. If you're going to complain, don't complain to your mom about your husband.
Right.
Complain to his mom, because your mom will never forgive him. And so I did a lot of reading and tried to pass along the best bits of advice I could find. And somebody said writers are like beggars who tell other beggars where they find bread. And so where I found some bread, I tried to put it in the book.
I was thinking my parents have been married more than 40 years, and my dad retired at the end of 2018. And I called the other day. I called my mom's cell phone, and it was really loud. And I'm like, where are you? And she's like, oh, we just went to Epcot for the day. And they were just like, I couldn't even describe to you how surprised I was that my two parents were just kind of off having a day at a theme park. Right. I live in Tampa, Florida, and they just headed over to Orlando. And I could tell it was just because they were enjoying each other and thought It might be a fun way to spend the day. And I kind of hope I get there.
Yeah, no, I tell my college students, it's hard to get college students to think about marriage, but I say it's a 50-year conversation. Find somebody you can talk to for the rest of your life. And you don't want to be one of those silent couples we see at the diners who are just sitting there, not talking to each other, just silently. And then I say, you know, there are certain traits you should look for, and there's a lot of psychological research on this. Look for agreeableness. Like, kindness doesn't seem to be like the most sexy virtue on earth, but in a marriage partner, it's really important. And neuroticism, which is making a drama out of everything, that's to be avoided.
And it's okay to work on it a little bit. It doesn't have to fit effortlessly
right,
in marriage.
No, I mean, that's the beautifying thing of any commitment. It requires more of it than you knew you had to give. And so it demands that you give more than you thought you were capable of.
My guest this hour is David Brooks. His book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be back after a short break. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Brooks, New York Times columnist and author. His book is called The Second Mountain, and it's about the quest for a moral life. We have a lot of eager callers and questioners. I got an email question I want to share with you from Truett, who says, Mr. Brooks gave a very good commencement address at my daughter's graduation 10 years ago. My question is about a middle path. What are your thoughts on the fact that most of us do what we have to do and look for opportunities for meaningful action when possible?
Right. I think that, you know, most of us, you got to make a living. You got to pay the rent. And so sometimes if you're lucky, your vocation becomes a paying vocation. But sometimes it's not a paying vocation. Somebody once said, I quote in the book, and I'm not going to remember it at all, everybody has their work. Sometimes they get paid for their work. Sometimes they don't get paid for their work. But that doesn't mean it's not your work. And for some people, like being hospitable, my wife is just a great host. And I wouldn't say she gets paid for it. She doesn't get paid for it. But and she has a job and does writing. But hospitality is in some way her work.
Mm-hmm.
And she could do it in ways that welcome people into conferences or welcome into our home or welcome into a gathering that she's doing. And so being hospitable for a lot of people, that is a great way to weave community together, and we don't think of it classically as a job.
It's interesting. I really like to give compliments, and I enjoy telling my colleagues what they're good at. So people always ask me to be a reference for them because I truly delight in telling people why that person is valuable. So I mean, it may not be my job, but it is something I really derive joy from.
So words of affirmation are your love language.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing.
Yes, I have read that book, and you are absolutely correct. Let's take a call now from Muhammad in Arlington. Go ahead, Muhammad.
Hey, Courtney, thank you so much for this conversation. So my question to David is, my life started with my parents pushing us towards, you know, community work, moral work, helping the society and things like that. And that's where I actually spent thousands of hours, I would say, doing, you know, voluntary work and getting engaged with the community until I actually worked with nonprofits. I'm still to this day, I'm 30 years old now working with nonprofits. I just feel now that, you know, listening to David, that I've started off with the second mountain. But the idea that I missed out on the first mountain is always bugging me. It's something that I always go back to, or like I feel it around, you know, people who know me, that you missed out on the first mountain, which is a clear career path that, you know, you could have been a very successful, this very successful engineer. Now, what I do is very joyful. I truly enjoy it, and I know it's something valuable. I mean, I feel it. But how do I deal with the bugging notion that I missed out on the first mountain?
Well, the grass is always greener. And I don't want to leave the impression that being in a for-profit building business is first mountain and being in a nonprofit is second mountain. That sometimes is the case, but often not. I would say, you know, we know a lot about what makes people joyful and having deep relationships with others. And I make this distinction in the book you referenced at the top, that happiness is when the self expands and you win a victory, your team wins the Super Bowl, you get promoted. That's happiness, and that's good. I'm really for that. But joy is better. Joy is when you can't tell where you end and another person begins because you're so deeply in love with that person, or where you end and nature begins if you're out hiking in the woods, or where you end and God begins if you're a person of faith. And so I would say to Muhammad that if you're working with people and you're in a spot where, A, you're helping people, and, B, you're really getting to know them and they're really getting to know you at some deep level, you're seeing them at their depths, then you're at a very enviable spot. And you can live that way in a for-profit world or a nonprofit world. But I've just found being in relationship is a skill. Knowing how to do relationships well is something we don't teach in this country, but it's a skill, and it requires total honesty and total love, which sometimes sit in tension. But I would say it sounds like if you're doing community service, a lot of people who don't get to live in relationship with others may be feeling envious of you.
Why did you write this book?
You know, we writers work out our stuff in public. And so I'd mentioned in 2013, I went through a valley, and it was a valley of disconnection and loneliness. My marriage had ended. My kids had left home for college. And I had just have this stunning realization. I've been sucked up by the culture. And you think you're playing the game, but the game is playing you. And I was in the culture of the meritocracy, the culture of the individual. And I was not a good communicator with people. I mean, I communicate for a living, but I wasn't doing well with the people around me. And nobody ever confided in me because I didn't give off that vibe. And I valued time over people. I was always trying to be productive, so I was always sort of on the move. And my wife, it takes her an hour and a half to leave a party just because she likes the relationship. I'm like, let's get out of here. So I had fallen for some bad values at about the same time as a lot of the rest of the country had fallen for bad values. So how do we develop a culture that encourages relationships, that educates our emotions, and that deepens our souls? And we're fighting a lot of headwinds. I mean, technology is a headwind. How many times when you communicate through a cell phone do you say something truly out of the depth of your heart? It tends to be a much shallower form of communication. And so I looked at people who had done it, and I just wanted to learn from them. So I spent 5 years, how do you get out of a valley? What's the most joyful possible life?
And you said in the book that you had always kind of leaned in conservative circles, but even that was greatly challenged, you know, post 20, you know, I don't want to say exactly when, but it was challenged in recent years. Was that part of what was going on?
Yeah, that was another thing I lost. My mentor in life was William F. Buckley. And I worked for him, and Milton Friedman was another. And I worked on a lot of conservative outlets. I worked at the Wall Street Journal. I worked at the Weekly Standard. I worked at National Review. And the conservative movement was like a cause I dedicated part of my life to. But to me, conservatism today is unrecognizable compared to William F. Buckley's conservatism. So I sort of drifted away from those circles, and I sort of lost a sense of that cause.
And you said you intruded on the hospitality of friends too much during this time. How do you feel like your friendships now, after kind of this period in the Valley and also yeah. writing this book, how have they changed from a few years ago?
Yeah, they're well, first of all, when I was in the Valley, I like was so lonely that I did throw myself on my friends. And I felt really guilty doing that I was a burden on them. But now I think I'm a little more open personality. Now my friends throw themselves on me, and I'm always delighted. I like, oh, good, well, this is a chance for me to do some good, but also a chance to really deepen our friendship. And so for the first time, I would stay up late with some of my friends. There was a guy named Pete who he's a night owl like me. So we'd call at 11 and we'd talk. And what was interesting about Pete, when we would talk, say I would talk about something I was facing, he would ask the six questions that a friend asks. And then sort of rhythmically, I'd expect him to start giving advice. Mm-hmm. But then he'd ask another six questions. And I realized that's what makes him a good listener. He asks those extra six questions that you don't expect. And then he mulls it over. And so I learned from him a lot about listening.
And it's interesting you said you kind of threw yourself on your friends and felt guilty about it. Is part of that the problem when you're not living in joy? Are you holding yourself in check too and assuming the worst? Like, I can't possibly be a burden on this person, or I'm sure they're sick of me by now, or I must have done something to off-put them. Right. Is part of being joyful also trusting that you can, you know, lean on others and be a part of things fully?
Yeah, that, and it's sort of saying, you know, if I show my weakness, they'll still like me. I think in retrospect, I haven't really expressed it this way, but I think I had a sense I had to be like, I had to earn their love through just being really good at something. Mm-hmm. And that if I showed I was not really good, then they'd say, oh, he's kind of a loser. But it turns out you can reveal your weakness, and they won't say that. At least your true friends won't do that.
That's interesting First Mountain thinking, because you're right, it's all about kind of collecting accolades and really, really worrying about how other people see you and trying right. to achieve, right?
Yeah, and vulnerability is hard, and I'm more vulnerable in this book than I've ever been in my life before. And I'm a little nervous about that because it's not always a pleasant culture out there. But I didn't feel I could write about a book about relationship, which is based on vulnerability and trust, and not at least be vulnerable. And so I went there. And my first draft, I had none of myself in the book. And my readers, a friend of mine who was actually a student doing a little research for me, she said, you got to put yourself in this book. And so I did, and I hope it works out.
You have three grown kids, right?
Right.
I'm interested. Have you talked about a lot of this with them? Have they read the book? What are their thoughts? Because they're obviously a different generation than you are, yeah. and I'm just wondering kind of how they feel all of this.
Yeah, my older son thinks this is my best book, so that's good. and the other two have read bits and pieces of it. I don't think we've really talked about it. I like to let them have their lives. I mean, I'm a semi-public figure, so I don't like to, like, I'm on TV every week. I think throughout their childhoods, I'm not sure they ever saw me on TV, that it just, frankly, the NewsHour wasn't their sort of thing, or Meet the Press or something. If I'd been on the E! Network, or I don't know, that might have worked. But so we talk about their lives when I'm with them. And my eldest son was very gracious about the book, which meant a lot to me.
What do you think about just this notion of the second mountain? Is that something you've just discussed philosophically with them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the book, frankly, was written for them and for my students. Because a lot of it is, how do you choose a vocation? How do you choose a marriage partner? I mean, these are big decisions people make in their 20s. How do you regard a faith journey? How do you choose what community you're going to give to? And so a lot of the practical advice is for people who are young, who are making those big decisions. It's about, how do you make the biggest decisions of your life?
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Since I have you here, I would like to talk to you a little bit about your recent New York Times column on the Mueller report and kind of the revelations that you took from that. And it does, and there are many ways that it does tie into the book. I mean, you talk quite a bit about community and building relationships. And you speak quite frankly in that piece about, you know, you have some grave concerns about how our country is faring. So tell me kind of what your big takeaways were after you read it.
Yeah, I mean, the book is about the moral architecture of our society. And what struck me reading the Mueller report was that there are it brought together three different forces that are undermining the architecture and the infrastructure of our society, and just all together. And one is Donald Trump and the Trump administration. And I think he's undermining the systems and the institutions of our government. Every time he appears in that report, he's just riding roughshod over some rule or some precedent. And so he's just asking people to lie. He's asking people to not do their job. And so it's like a wrecking crew of how our government is supposed to work. The second thread is really the Russians, who are undermining the informational foundation of our society by introducing falsehood into it and making us distrust information sources. And then the third is WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, who's undermining the privacy that any organization needs. And whether it's the Democratic National Committee or the State Department, WikiLeaks takes what should be private and publishes it. And that's a danger because if you're going to deliberate in, say, the State Department or send cables back and forth, there has to be some privacy so you can deliberate together. And if there's no privacy, then information freezes. And so these are all three different threats to sort of the informational, systemic, and organizational infrastructure of society. And it's an attempt to undermine us. And what's interesting to me is those three forces, Trump, the Russians, and Julian Assange, all somehow understood they were part of the same big project.
How do you think the reaction of the administration, members of the cabinet, and also just kind of the conservative sphere in general has, do you think that reaction, is it surprising to you how in the wake of the report people have reacted, or is what you expected?
Yeah, by now I'm inured to the non-reaction of Republicans to things they privately think are appalling. Mitt Romney, I thought, did a good job. He really issued a strong statement about accurately summarizing the report. All the other Republicans, I know they shrug. It's like, what are you going to do? They can't criticize him because he's so popular within the party, and so they shrug. And then I think what I've seen among a lot of Republicans I know, they all, 2 years ago, they all really opposed Trump internally, even if they were pretending in public. And now a lot of them have talked themselves into thinking they support him internally. And so they just get in the game that it's us versus them, and he's us, so I guess we're for him.
Why do you think that's happened? Why have so many people maybe even privately and ideologically come around?
Yeah, I think it's probably psychically hard to be split with oneself, have some private belief, and then publicly say the opposite. So it's since you can't change the public and keep your job if you're a politician, then you switch the private. And I think there's just the ebb and flow of combat, and they see Democrats attacking, and they don't like the Democrats, so they want to attack them.
While reading the book, I noted, interestingly, that you have a lot of different kind of sources that are featured. You quote novels and you interview real people and you talk to the experts and you cite, you know, psychologists. What, when you were putting this all together, did anything really catch you off guard or surprise you or delight you even?
Well, I will say, I don't know if my parts of the book are good, but the quotations in the book are really good. I spent 6 years collecting them, and they were things that meant a lot to me.
A lot of Fitzgerald, right?
A lot of Fitzgerald. I mean, I quote Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, George Eliot, Annie Dillard's in there a lot. So they were just bits, pearls of wisdom that really helped me a lot. And so I just jammed it in there, and maybe the book is overstuffed, but I figured this, if this helped me, maybe it'll help somebody else. So I say I'm not really a writer in this book. I'm a teacher. There's a curriculum of how to live well. And I just try to pass it along.
And we're nearly out of time, but you've got to share with me the reaction that Dostoevsky had when he found out he wasn't going to get executed and instead would just be in prison forever.
Right. He was returned to his prison cell. He was about to be shot, and they stayed the execution on the mercy of the Tsar. And they returned to the prison cell, and some of the men in the group who were going to be shot went mad. But he just started singing at the top of his lungs. And he had his first mountain experience end that moment. And he said, life is good, life is animated, I'm going to be the most perfect and joyous man for the rest of my days. And the rest of his literary career reflects that interest in love and connection.
My guest this hour was David Brooks, New York Times columnist and best-selling author. His book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. David, thank you so much for taking the time. What a great conversation.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.